And then today's training is on the Keeping Children Safe Act. Karen Omi is here. She's the program director for the Clearing House on Supervised Visitation, and she's going to discuss sexual abuse issues. And Sonia Crockett is going to talk about the actual act, the Keeping Children Safe Act. So with that, I'll let them start.
Okay, this is Sonia Crockett, and I am a former guardian ad litem program attorney. I was with the Second Judicial Circuit here in Tallahassee, and I haven't practiced for several years, so my teaching today is from the ivory tower. So perhaps after I finish my portion of the presentation, if there are questions, we can stop and take those questions. And if there are any of you from the circuits who have had actual experience with the Keeping Children Safe Act, we can maybe get some anecdotes about what has been happening as far as this statute is concerned. Because the statute did become effective a year and a half ago on July 1st, 2007. We did our first training, Karen and I did the first training on July 13th, 2007. And that training has been available online at the Guardian Ad Litem website, but now the CLE credit has lapsed. So I am going to reiterate much of the material from that first training because the law hasn't changed. And I know, knowing the Guardian Ad Litem program as I do, there's probably a few new attorneys out there in the last who've come on board in the last 18 months. But for them and for the long-timers, you will get one CLE credit for this training. So I will talk about one case that I have uncovered, or actually it was Karen's intern who uncovered a circuit court decision that directly impacts on the Keeping Children Safe Act, and that came out of the Sixth Judicial Circuit. So if we have anyone from the Sixth Judicial Circuit, maybe we can hear what's been happening there after part of this law was declared unconstitutional, but I'll get into that further. To begin, the intent of the Keeping Children Safe Act was to protect children and to reduce the risk of further harm to children who have been sexually abused or exploited by a parent or other caregiver by placing additional requirements on judicial determinations related to visitation and other contact. The law does this by establishing a rebuttable presumption that visitation by a parent or caregiver who has a history of certain crimes or I'm going to list them out, but who has a history of a crime or a hotline abuse report that involves sexual abuse, that there's a rebuttable presumption that this person should not have visitation or contact with the child. And once this information comes to light, it's an automatic termination of that parent or caregiver's visitation until a hearing is set and the judge can decide whether visitation should be continued or should be prohibited or should be continued with some sort of restrictions. So what we have to look at is whether a parent or caregiver has been reported to the child abuse hotline with an allegation of sexual abuse of any child. And we look to the definitions in section 39.01 of sexual abuse. Okay, that's one way to trigger the Keeping Children Safe Act. A second way is that this parent or caregiver has been found guilty regardless of adjudication of any of the following crimes. Section 787.04, relating to removing minors from the state or concealing minors contrary to court order. Secondly, Section 794.01, which is the sexual battery statute. Section 798.02, which is lewd and lascivious behavior. Chapter 800, which involves lewdness and indecent exposure. Section 826.04, which is the incest statute, and Chapter 827, which is a general abuse of children statute. Now, entering a plea of guilty or no contest would be sufficient to trigger this act, so it doesn't take a conviction by a jury. All right, the third way that the Keeping Children Safe Act is triggered is that a parent or caregiver has been determined to be a sexual predator, as defined in Section 775.21. If any of these crimes or ones substantially similar occurred in other jurisdictions, that would suffice under the Keeping Children Safe Act. In the written materials that I prepared, and they would have been sent out yesterday, Liz sent them out yesterday in an email, I pointed out that not all of these crimes involve child victims, such as the sexual battery statute. Furthermore, this list includes crimes that are not sexual crimes, such as concealing minors contrary to court order. Also, Chapter 827 makes abuse a crime, but also criminalizes non-supportive dependents and misuse of child support money. So I raised the issue of whether these types of non-sexual crimes should be included in the Keeping Children Safe Act. It doesn't seem like they should trigger that this rebuttable presumption of detriment to a child. Included in the material sent out yesterday is an article from the Florida Bar Journal from April of 2008, written by Judge Sue Robbins from the Fifth Circuit. It's entitled Florida Statute Section 39.0139, Limiting the Risk of Serious Harm to Children. Judge Robbins criticizes, and rightly I believe, this overbroadness of the Keeping Children Safe Act and recommends that it be amended so that it does not apply to cases which its application is not intended. So, again, if you have a parent who's been convicted of non-support of dependents, why should all this very heavy-handed, you know, termination of visitation until of hearing in the future, why should that occur? Hopefully, if this comes up at perhaps a shelter hearing, a judge would make a decision right at that time. No, this is not the type of case that the Keeping Children Safe Act, or the type of crime that the Keeping Children Safe Act was intended to cover. So my assumption when I did this training in July of 2007 was that at a shelter hearing, it would be DCF who would have the abuse hotline reports and the FDLE criminal background checks. And the department attorney would make the judge aware of any abuse report or criminal conviction that falls under Section 39.01393A. If the department or the judge does not address this, I've always thought that whoever is representing the GAL at the shelter hearing would say, Your Honor, we need to take into account the Keeping Children Safe Act provisions and make sure that those are covered. And perhaps now it's a stand on the Department of Children and Families forms, it's a standard line that this has been taken into consideration. If any of the criteria is met, the judge is required to suspend any visitation or contact with that parent or caretaker until there is a hearing on the issue of whether contact is detrimental to the child. For example, if the child abuse hotline report was closed with no indicators, there, I would hope, again, that the judge would make a decision at that point, no, this should not trigger the Keeping Children Safe Act, and the parent's visitation would not be impacted by this law. But in the case where there is a verified report of sexual abuse of any child by a parent or caregiver, the law requires that there be no contact by that parent with the child in the dependency case and that a hearing be set. also if one of those crimes, like sexual abuse or incest or any in that list of crimes, if you have an FDLE report showing that the parent has been convicted of that, again, visitation is prohibited. And if we're talking about shelter hearing, prohibited at the time of the shelter, and the judge should set a hearing to further explore whether visitation is detrimental to the child. Now, no time limit is given in the statute as to when that hearing should be held. Once the hearing is held, a guardian ad litem or an attorney ad litem must be appointed if one has not already been appointed. Most likely, that guardian ad litem would have been appointed at the shelter hearing, but if one has not been appointed at this hearing on the Keeping Children Safe Act hearing, one must be appointed. Now, this attorney ad litem or guardian ad litem must have special training in the dynamics of child sexual abuse, and that's specifically set out in the statute. Karen Omi is going to give an overview of the dynamics of sexual abuse today, but our presentation today would not, in our opinion, and it's the opinion of Karen and me, be sufficient for a guardian ad litem or attorney ad litem to be able to say that he or she has received special training in the dynamics of sexual abuse. What we recommend, and what some GALs have done in the last 18 months, is to go online to the Clearinghouse for Supervised Visitation website, and there's a link to the page in the materials Karen and I prepared, and take that training. I think if you go onto the Guardian Ad Litem website, that link is there also, and I think Liz is going to make it, put it in several places so that guardians ad litem, attorneys ad litem, anyone can go and link onto that page and take that training. It is geared toward persons who will work at supervised visitation centers, so there it does have some extraneous material, but it contains a lot of good information and that a guardian would need to understand the dynamics of child sexual abuse. Once completed, once you do that online training, a certificate of completion or compliance can be printed. And I would think it would be advisable to have a copy of that certificate in the guardian ad litem's file, or perhaps even in the court file of the case which triggers the Keeping Children Safe Act, so that it's very clear that the guardian ad litem program has complied with the law. At the hearing, the burden of proof shifts to the parent who has this child abuse hotline report or has a conviction of one of those crimes in the list, or has been designated a sexual predator. The burden shifts to that parent to show that visitation with that parent would not be detrimental. The court may rely on any relevant and material evidence submitted, including written or oral reports, to the extent of its probative value, even if this evidence may not be competent in an adjudicatory hearing. If the parent or caregiver proves by clear and convincing evidence that the safety, well-being, and physical, mental, and emotional health of the child is not endangered by contact with the parent, the presumption of detriment is rebutted and visitation can be ordered. A written order should be entered with any conditions the judge feels necessary to protect the child. So perhaps the judge doesn't feel that visitation should be terminated or prohibited or continue to be prohibited, but does feel like it should be supervised in some way. The judge always has that ability under Chapter 39, but at that Keeping Children Safe Act hearing, the judge can enter the visitation order if the parent has overcome that rebuttable presumption. If the presumption of detriment is not rebutted, the visitation may be prohibited or restricted. If allowed, the visitation can occur in one of two ways. First, it can be allowed at a supervised visitation program that complies with the minimum standards approved by the Supreme Court in 1999 and that has policies and guidelines specifically related to referrals involving child sexual abuse. And maybe Karen can address this, but I think all of the supervised visitation programs that Karen deals with in the state of Florida would comply under this section. So any of them in our state would be able to supervise visitation with a parent who has these sexual abuse convictions, abuse reports, or has been deemed a sexual predator. Secondly, visitation can be supervised by a person who has received specialized training in the dynamics of child sexual abuse. Now, you know, sometimes there might be a relative who wants to supervise visitation. That can occur if that relative has the specialized training. And the only way that I know that the relative could get it, unless they are a therapist with some, you know, some training in this area, or, you know, some professional with training in this area, I should say, not necessarily a therapist. But if they don't have that training, they can go to this online training and get the certificate. Now, I can imagine that it might be a guardian ad litem who is interested in a relative providing this kind of supervision. The guardian ad litem can help to make sure that that relative gets the online training and the certificate. And again, I would think it would be wise to have that filed, a copy of it filed in the court file. I would, in thinking about who else might be able to supervise the visitation, it could be a therapist, but I would think it would be advisable to have something showing that this therapist has had this specialized sexual abuse training. Maybe they've gone to some conference or gotten some kind of continuing education certificate, and you'd want to be sure that that person has the training that would comply with the statute. Again, the statute's very general, but if you have a therapist who's done some kind of sexual abuse of children training, that's going to be better than nothing. To complete this overview of the Act, we need to talk about two more sections. The first is attempts to influence the testimony of the child. Any party or participant who becomes aware of a person's attempts to influence a child who will be testifying in court based on communication with the child or firsthand knowledge should inform the court. The judge should immediately suspend the visitation and schedule a hearing to determine whether it's in the child's best interest to continue to prohibit or restrict the visitation. Again, I've always thought it's most likely the guardian ad litem who would become aware of this kind of information because of the GAL's role in the child's life. As a person connected with the court system, a child may be inclined to tell the guardian ad litem about talking with mommy or daddy about going to court. Also, being in the child's home, the guardian ad litem may overhear conversations about court testimony. If this happens, the GAL attorney should file a motion setting out the circumstances along with an order that suspends the visitation, because this is going to be an ex parte motion and hearing. Ex parte motion and order. And so because this would occur without a hearing, I would advise that this either be a sworn motion or that the guardian ad litem prepare, or the attorney prepare for the guardian ad litem, an affidavit, and that it be attached with the motion supporting the suspension of visitation. The statute does not set out a time limitation on the hearing, you know, when should it be held, but the guardian ad litem attorney should be diligent in seeing that the hearing is set, as this action infringes on an important right of the parent and child to have contact with each other. The last section of the Act concerns the child's therapy. The material sent out yesterday is not as clear as it should be, that the provisions of the Act covers therapy that is ongoing as a result of any allegation or conviction contained in 39.01393A. So if that therapist reports that visitation or contact is impeding the child's therapeutic progress, the court must convene a hearing within 7 business days to review the appropriateness of the continued visitation. So see, that's different than the termination of the visitation in the previous section, which had to do with testimony of the child, because that happens immediately. Also, I would think that at any time a therapist feels that the child's therapeutic process is being hindered by a parent's contact with the child, that issue should be brought before the court. But under the Keeping Children Safe Act, it clearly should be addressed. Again, I feel that because guardians usually stay in contact with the child's therapist, it will be the guardian whom the therapist calls to report his or her concerns. The guardian ad litem program attorney should ask the therapist to provide those concerns in writing and attach it to a motion to suspend visitation. Just want to address grandparents' rights. As you probably know, under 39.509, grandparents whose grandchildren are involved in the dependency system are entitled to reasonable visitation unless that visitation would interfere with the goals of the case plan. But furthermore, under 39.509, it specifically states that any order of grandparent visitation must conform to the provisions of the Keeping Children Safe Act. Since the Act became effective in July of 2007, no appellate decisions have been issued addressing 39.0139, or I should say none that I or Karen's intern found. And I told you that there is one trial court decision from the Sixth Circuit which held one section of the Act unconstitutional. This was Judge Chris Hellinger in Pasco County, and the order was signed in December 2007. I checked with the assistant state attorney on the case, and she said the decision was made in her office not to appeal the order. But I thought you might be interested in what Judge Hellinger found, even though it doesn't have application outside that Sixth Judicial Circuit. This case concerned a father who was the subject of a hotline abuse report alleging he sexually abused his stepson and his biological daughter. He had not had any contact with his daughter in 8 months, according to the order. I found this a little bit strange since the statute only became effective on July 1st, 2007, and that order was signed December 21st, 2007, so it shouldn't have been more than 6 months that Keeping Children Safe Act had kept that father from seeing his daughter, but that's a mystery to me. I don't know why that is. So, this Judge Hellinger found that Section 39.0139 impinges on a fundamental liberty interest, that is the right of a parent to the care, custody, and management of their children. So he found that a strict scrutiny standard must be used to analyze the statute's constitutionality. Under the strict scrutiny test, the statute must serve a compelling state interest through the least intrusive means possible. The father did not dispute that sections 39.01393A 2 and 3 would pass the strict scrutiny test. And just to remind you, subsection 3 deals with persons designated as sexual predators. And subsection 2 is that list of crimes I set out earlier. Interestingly, the order reads, "This subsection prevents a parent or caregiver's contact with the minor child after pleas and adjudications for certain crimes committed against children." Now, as I said earlier, and that list of crimes is not only crimes committed against children. So, as Judge Robbins pointed out in her Bar Journal article, this subsection includes sexual crimes committed against adults. So I would think the argument could be made that it is overbroad in its scope. For example, if a father has a 10-year-old conviction for rape against an adult woman, should his right to visit his child be automatically terminated until the court gets around to a hearing at some unknown time in the future? So that might be another ground for attacking that statute. But back to the Sixth Judicial Circuit case, the father argued and the judge agreed that Section 39.01393A1, and that's the one that deals with child hotline abuse reports, fails to pass the second prong of the strict scrutiny test that the state must use the least restrictive means possible to achieve its compelling interest. Judge Hellinger finds problems in several areas. First, there's no time frame in which the hearing must be held, unlike other hearings in Chapter 39, which have definite times in which to conduct hearings, such as shelter, arraignment, and adjudicatory hearings. Secondly, there's no notice before the right of visitation is restricted. It's cut off immediately. And thirdly, the rules of evidence do not apply at the hearing when it is held, whenever it's held. And I guess in the one before Judge Hellinger, it took 8 months to get it to court. Fourth, shifting the burden of proof to the parent. Judge Hellinger points out that Chapter 39 doesn't do this at any other point. So the judge is concerned about a parent losing a fundamental right, contact with a child, based on an anonymous call to the hotline with no ability of the parent to confront that caller. Based on all of these reasons, Section 39.01393A1 is unconstitutional as a violation of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and Article 1, Section 9 of the Florida Constitution. Now, that's Judge Hellinger's opinion, and that was included in the material emailed out to everyone yesterday.
Yeah.
The materials also included two Florida Bar Journal articles, one of which I've already mentioned, the one by Judge Sue Robbins. She wrote in response to an article in the March 2008 Bar Journal entitled Florida Statute Section 39.0139, Protecting Children from Sexual Abuse by Those Entrusted with Their Care. The authors of that March 2008 Bar Journal article argue that the Keeping Children Safe Act applies not only to Chapter 39 proceedings, but also to proceedings under Chapter 61, the Dissolution of Marriage Statute, Chapter 742, the Domestic Violence Statute, and any other proceeding relating to visitation and other contact with a child. The authors of that article take the position that the statutory language is clear and unambiguous in the legislative findings and intent when it states, it is the intent of the legislature to protect children and reduce the risk of further harm to children who have been sexually abused or exploited by a parent or other caregiver by placing additional requirements on judicial determinations related to visitation and other contact. So, the authors then examine other bills that were filed at the same time, but which did not contain language that restricted application of the law to any person involved in a proceeding under this chapter. So they looked at other bills filed at the same time which died, and those bills contain language that restricted application of the law to any persons involved in a proceeding under this chapter, meaning Chapter 39. Because the section that was passed did not contain this language, but speaks of additional requirements on judicial determinations related to visitation and contact, these authors take the position that all judicial determinations relating to visitation and contact should be covered by the Keeping Children Safe Act.
Yeah.
Now, in the next month's issue, Judge Robbins comes to the opposite conclusion. Same law, opposite conclusion. This is what keeps us lawyers in business and gives those law professors grist for the law review mills. As I said earlier, Judge Robbins' article goes further in criticizing other problems with the statute, such as the overbroadness of that list of crimes that triggers the act. So if you have time to only read one of the articles, I would recommend Judge Robbins' article. On the subject of glitches, or more serious constitutional problems with the statute, I looked to see if any bills have been filed for the 2009 session, and as of this time, I found that none have been filed, but the deadline for filing has not passed yet. I think it's the end of February. So I'll stop there, but I would ask that if anybody has a question, or what I would like to hear is something from the practitioner's viewpoint of how this law has been working in the last year and a half. And then we'll switch it over to Karen to talk about the dynamics of sexual abuse.
Apply to sexual predators or sexual offenders?
Predators. That's the net packet.
I hear someone having a discussion.
This is Christine Adler from Hernando office.
Yes.
My question is that this only applies to sexual predators, not sexual offenders that are registered.
If you look at... Yes, it specifically says sexual predator as defined in 775.21.
So even though there's a sexual offender that is charged with the lewd and lascivious on a minor, et cetera, that does not apply here.
What is the, would that be under 798.02?
I'm not sure.
Hopefully that would be included in that list of crimes in subparagraph 2, the ones that were talking about sexual battery, lewd and lascivious behavior, lewdness and indecent exposure. And hopefully that would be included under that list.
And does this only apply to the child that's been sexually abused, or does this apply to any siblings or any other children in the home?
It's any child.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Okay, Karen, are you there?
I am. I'm here. If there are no more questions, then I'll go ahead and get started. Thank you very much, Sonia. We only have a few minutes.
Hello?
Oh, can you hear us?
Yes. Was there a question?
Yes. The specialized training,
yes.
The guardian ad litem should be appointed to supervise the visit test at specialized training. Are we going to provide some specialized training, or have we, or... How do we address that with the court?
Yes, and that's exactly what we're addressing now.
Excellent.
So what I'm providing is sort of the little 20-minute overview of what the sexual abuse training on child sexual abuse issues looks like. It's sort of a little overview, and then, as Sonia mentioned early on in her presentation, we have an online training that's available 24/7 on an FSU website. And there are going to be several links to it on the Guardian Ad Litem website. And the great thing about this curriculum is that it's competency-based. And so it's going to be up to program directors with their own personnel rules. I mean, we're not going to micromanage how you do this. But what we would hope is that people who do get assigned sexual abuse cases, or cases that include child sexual abuse issues, would take this training. At the end of the training, there's a little form that you fill out, and you can print out a certificate of completion right there. Sign the certificate of completion and present it to the program director. Now, it is all done on the honor system, okay? But there's really not too much we can do about this, because the bells and whistles that would be necessary to put some real tight security around this and to make sure, for instance, that people spent 3 or 4 hours on the website, you know, all the different kinds of security bells and whistles that we'd have to add would make it cost prohibitive. So right now it's very cheap. It's available online. You can print out a certificate of completion. What program directors can decide to do, and I'm not telling you you have to do this, but for instance, for supervised visitation programs, what directors do is they actually collect the quizzes. There are competency-based means that there are quizzes at the end of each chapter. There are case examples. There are questions to consider. Just like a regular online curriculum that you might take if you took a college course online, except we don't have outside reading. We don't mandate outside reading. So program directors can decide what to them meets the requirement that people have special training in the dynamics of child sexual abuse, okay, so that the guardian ad litem programs themselves can make that determination. The training is available for them to look at and make those determinations. You can do as little as a quiz at the very end of the manual. You can do quizzes at the end of each module, each chapter. And some programs, some supervised visitation programs even, require that the trainees take the internal quizzes, answer the questions after the case scenarios. So that's really, you know, going to be up to you, but I wanted you to know that that's what's out there. And what I'm going to do is just kind of explain why it's so difficult to learn about this, these issues. I mean, I've done this training now in many different forms over the last several years, actually over the last 6 years. And people have a hard time with this training. Now, I can understand that, you know, you guardians, you've seen a lot. You've seen, you know, the really terrible things that have happened to children. And yet there is still, and I will tell you, you just have to take my word for it, there is still a wall around issues of child sexual abuse, that people have very strong emotional reactions to this training. And I'm not saying necessarily the attorneys, but certainly guardians, even the most, you know, jaded of guardians or experienced of guardians, they have emotional reactions, shame, shock, anger. They can be ambivalent because when they meet the parent who is alleged to be an offender, the accused offender seems so nice, and it's the non-offending parent who might seem hysterical. The guardian might experience anxiety. You know, what if the child is re-victimized? You know, there's so much at stake in this case. People also get depressed. They have responses such as denial. If the child seems happy, how could this awful thing that a mom alleges have happened to this child? You know, there's no outward signs. It's a crime committed. I mean, sometimes there are, of course, in cases where there are obvious physical injuries, sometimes there are signs. But much more often than not, this is a crime that is committed in private, and the signs are kept quiet, secret. There's a, you know, huge amount of shame and embarrassment about these issues. And so the staff who have to now learn about these cases can get very, very angry, and people who are assigned these cases can have a whole range of emotional reactions. Now, one of the reasons that people have, and I really never tied these two together for the first few trainings that I did, but one of the reasons that people have such strong reactions to the issue of child sexual abuse might be because of the prevalence and incidence of child sexual abuse. Preeminent researcher on the issue of child sexual abuse, his name is David Finkelhor, and he has been around forever. And he says that there is considerable accumulated evidence that at least 20% of American women and 5 to 10% of American men experienced some form of sexual abuse as children. Okay. Child sexual abuse is kept quiet vastly more often than it is revealed. And a very large chunk of American society have experienced this victimization, which can go a long way toward explaining why people have these emotional reactions on this training, when they're exposed to this training. So when I have done large group live trainings, I'm a lawyer, not a therapist, and I have learned that when I do large groups, if I have more than, say, 50 people, and I've done it for up to 200 people, I've had to have mental health professionals in little offices and little rooms outside of the training room to deal with the adults who break down in tears, who stand up and leave the room, who are panicked and are suffering from huge amounts of grief because they're dealing with their own victimization issues, their own history of victimization, which they may or may not have dealt with before. And I have seen time and time again, this is terrible training to have to do because it happens every single time. So that being said, what I want people to, and I'm not sure if I've got program directors on the line, you know, or program attorneys, the reason that I'm telling you this is because it's very important for people who deal with these kinds of cases to have dealt with their own unresolved emotional issues, their own histories of victimizations. And that's really touchy. That's really difficult, and I'm not going to tell you how to do it because there's not going to be one answer for every program. And you're not going to, the directors are probably not going to come right out and say to their, you know, new trainees or their guardians, were you sexually abused as a kid? I mean, that's not going to be appropriate. On the other hand, there may be ways to let guardians know that there may be some cases that it would be better that they didn't take. And this is your classic example for two reasons, and then I'll get into more dynamics. For two reasons. One is, of course, your unresolved emotional responses. If somebody has suffered from abuse and they haven't dealt with those issues, or even if they have, they may experience unanticipated emotional reactions to visits between a child and a parent who's accused of similar abuse. Okay, that's a very real issue. Even if a person thinks that the door has been closed and they have dealt with that issue, it may come just flooding back to them. And that leads me to the second reason why you should be really careful about this and who gets assigned to these cases, and that's because of how things can look in a trial or in a courtroom setting. You'd be amazed at the number of people who have had their own victimization histories who find a opportunity to tell somebody in the case. And we've had this happen with supervised visitation workers who sort of blurt out to the non-offending parent, I know how this feels. I was abused as a child. And this kind of thing comes out, and it can be used to discredit the monitor's observations of the visits, or it can be used to discredit the guardian's information, the guardian's report, the guardian's conclusion. So I want you to be real careful about that. And it's not in the outline that you've got on the guardian page, but it is part of the training. And so people, you know, be ready to have referrals to community resources, and this is more, I guess, advice to program directors. And I'm sure that you've probably had these kinds of situations and other issues of child, you know, somebody's former child abuse. But you have to be ready for it with child sex issues. So that being said, we've now talked about incidents that, unfortunately, child sexual abuse is a very large problem. It's a very traumatic problem. And the reason that the legislature, we think, wanted people to be trained on it is because it really does affect, it's going to affect the child for the rest of the child's life. And it's also, if it remains invisible, remember I talked about this is a crime that's committed in private, behind closed doors. And if it remains invisible, then the guardian ad litem, whose task it is to really help this child, cannot help this child. Okay, now, let's go ahead on to common myths and facts about child sexual abuse. And again, these are in the training. They go into a lot more detail, and there's a lot more myths and facts. But there are certain myths and facts that people need to be aware about. The first one is, the myth is that the typical sexual abuser is a stranger. And the fact is that strangers are sexual offenders in only 8 to 10% of child sexual abuse cases. Family members and friends are the vast majority of offenders in child sexual abuse cases. But you guys see, we see when we turn on the TV, these terrible cases of strangers who pop out of nowhere and hurt a child. And those cases, those things do happen. But the majority of sexual abuse is actually, unfortunately, committed by people that the child knows. Another myth, and this one I want you to, you know, I really want you to try to remember these and try to think about these. Another myth that has been rebuked is that allegations of child sexual abuse are really common in disputed custody cases. And there have been studies, large caseload studies, that show that this is not true. Now, it is true that there have also been some high-profile divorce cases that have included allegations of child sexual abuse. But the vast majority of filings of dissolution in this state and nationally and, in fact, in the Western world, the vast majority of divorce cases, even disputed custody cases, do not have allegations of child sexual abuse. And the reason I'm telling you this is because there have been times when supervised visitation programs staff have suspected that there's child abuse and have called the hotline and have been asked by the person who answers the hotline, oh, well, is this a custody case? Because if it's a custody case, then the clear implication is that the allegation's probably not true. Any allegation that you do hear about child sexual abuse, you have to be very sensitive to and do not immediately dismiss it simply because there might be some underlying litigation involving that child. The next myth that I need you to understand is that a lot of people believe that sexual offenders can be cured. And it's really important to know that the American Society for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers say there's no cure for adult sexual offenders. There are treatments, but you have to remember that these treatments are geared toward having an offender acknowledge his or her behavior and then develop strategies and tools to help them to control the behavior. So treatment is more about control than it is about curing. Now, remember I said that was adult sexual offenders. I mean, the good news is, and I won't be able to, because I'm looking at the time, I won't be able to talk very much about this, but the good news is that when we start talking about juvenile sexual offenders, researchers have much more optimism that young sexual offenders can be treated and, quote-unquote, cured. And so I would think that guardians would think that was a really important piece of information, because you are going to, if you haven't already, if there's nobody on this line who's ever felt that they've dealt with a juvenile sexual offender, you're probably missing something, because there are cases of juvenile sexual offenders, and again, the problem is that a lot of times this behavior is invisible. You don't know what to look for. You're not sure what you're seeing. You dismiss what you're seeing because you think you couldn't possibly jump to that conclusion. But there are juvenile sexual offenders, and the good news about that is that there is much more chance that they can be treated and there's more optimism that they can be cured. And then the last myth that I just want to go into, and I said, you know, as I said, there's more of these online. The biggest myth is that most professionals believe that they can tell whether someone is a sexual offender by looking at them and talking to them. And I'm not sure if you've fallen into that trap before. I know I've been tempted to. When you talk to a person who's been accused of a heinous crime, and that person just doesn't seem capable of having committed that crime, and child molesters can look like everybody else. They're motivated by a variety of influences. There is not a typical child molester. There's no test and no instrument that reliably determines whether a person has sexually abused a child or has not sexually abused a child. So, and what researchers tell us is that the most striking characteristic of sex offenders, of child sexual offenders, from a diagnostic standpoint, is their apparent normality. And that's a very strong statement, because a lot of you have dealt with lots of different parents, lots of different children. You've got a lot of experiences, in the court system, you've dealt with a lot of different kinds of people, and so it's easy to feel tempted to diagnose, to be able to look at somebody and think, I can tell. And researchers who've done this for years and years and years admit that they cannot. All right. Okay, now, probably the last 10 minutes, I want to go ahead about and talk about a very important concept that folks need to understand whenever dealing with issues of child sexual abuse, and this is what's called the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome. And it was developed by a guy named Roland Summit back in the 80s, and he developed this set of categories and this chart to pretty much explain to people, to adults, who could not possibly comprehend how something this grievous and this heinous could happen to a child and the child wouldn't tell. Okay? It is probably, you know, one of the biggest walls that abused children have to deal with in telling adults what has happened to them, because adults just feel like, oh my God, if something like this ever happened to me, I'd be dialing 911. Okay? I'd be dialing 911. And how did a child basically learn to live with that word accommodation? Is basically, how does a child learn to live with, learn to cope with, learn to exist with victimization, sexual victimization? And the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome talks about that. So the first thing you have to understand is secrecy. So there are these five components of the syndrome. The first one is secrecy, and it helps explain a lot. And you're probably familiar with this, that the idea is that the offender communicates somehow to the victim that the sexual behavior is a secret. Okay? So overtly, the offender can say things like, if you tell me, they'll put me in jail, especially when it's, you know, a caregiver of the child. If you tell them, they're going to put me in jail. There can also be threats. If you tell, I'll kill your mother, I'll kill your sister, I'll kill the family pet, you know, these kinds of things. And the victim feels afraid, right? Is very scared. The victim may also have been enjoying some special attention that she has received from the perpetrator. And that's this issue of grooming, that in some cases a child could be in the bed at night and suddenly have somebody walk in the door, have the caregiver walk in the door and rape the child. I mean, that has happened. But more often there's a progression of sexual abuse, at least in the research. And, of course, you know, the research is about the cases we know about. But there is a progression of child sexual abuse that starts with what we call the grooming process. And that is where the perpetrator gets the child used to increasing levels of physical contact, and then the physical contact becomes sexual. So at first, the child may very, very much enjoy the extra attention, okay? The hair brushing, the stroking, the lap sitting, you know, all kinds of things that can go into added physical attention. And then when the physical attention becomes sexual, the child has some ambivalence, because the child wants the added attention but doesn't want the sexual contact. And at this point, the offender is making sure that the victim understands that this is something just between them. We've heard fathers say to daughters, this is what a father does with his daughter to teach his daughter. We have seen a child threatened. I'm going to get in big trouble if you tell. And I'm going to be sent to jail, or you're going to be sent to jail because what we're doing is wrong. All right, so this issue of secrecy is a very big issue. And the next category in the accommodation syndrome is this feeling of helplessness. The offender is now taking advantage of this natural power and authority that adults hold over children. And as a result of that power and authority, the victim feels powerless to stop the abuse. The next category is entrapment and accommodation. Okay, so now the at this point, especially if we're talking about the ongoing sexual abuse, the offender is lying, distorting his actions. repeatedly engaging in sexual victimization behaviors and making the child feel as though it's not, the child has to cope with it, keep her mouth shut or his mouth shut, and the child has no way to get out of it. Okay, so the child now feels, in order to survive, I have to get used to it. I have to find a way to live while this is happening to me. And it's a part of a child's survival skills. When you learned about domestic violence, you probably learned about a victim's survival skills. Category 4 is disclosure. Now, what you need to understand about disclosure is that disclosure of child sexual abuse is generally not an event. It's a process. And the studies show that time and time and time again, children believe they are trying to disclose. They may say something to an adult, and the adult shuts down because what they're saying is a terrible thing. Or they say something to an adult, and an adult freaks out. And so the child recants. And recanting is the last part of the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome. The offender, of course, is going to be denying. The offender continues to deny, convincing the non-offending adults that abuse did not occur. There's increasing pressure on the child to take it back. And once a child discloses, the child's world changes in a huge way, as though a tornado goes through that child's life. The child is generally plucked from the home, or the offender is plucked from the home. The child may be going to a different school. The person, the breadwinner of the family, may now no longer have a job, may no longer be supporting the family. The child may not have the same friends. The child's non-offending parent may be extremely upset with this child, because non-offending parents have a variety of responses that you'll learn about in the training. And the family's response can be denial and rationalization and minimization and anger, even anger at the victim, and shame and sadness, and can we just make this go away? And, of course, this whole issue of not being able to cure, you know, researchers really doubting that they can cure sexual offenders, basically the non-offending parent believes, well, now that it's out in the open, now it'll stop. And so we don't need to do this, you know, we don't need to have all these interventions. We don't need to be so crazy. Okay, so those are the 5 categories. And the issue of recanting and disclosure, I wanted to just touch on briefly, because I assume that the Guardian Ad Litem program already has some training on what happens if a child discloses to you, you know, if a child does disclose. But let me just tell you that we tell supervised visitation programs that every single person should be reviewing, you know, pretty periodically the rules for what happens if a child does disclose to you, or starts to disclose, or you think that the child is trying to tell you something. You know, the most important thing is that you don't yourself don't shut the child down, okay? But don't take it upon yourself to become the interviewer. You know, don't take it upon yourself to get information from this child, because you are not an expert, and I don't want you to endanger the future court case, okay? So please make sure that in your programs you do have some type of a training on what to do when a child discloses to you. And getting enough information just to make that abuse report and giving the child's story credence. In other words, I'm going to report this to somebody who can help you and who is an expert in this. You know, that is much better than saying, where did it happen, when did it happen, what was said, because then you're basically setting the child up to be contradicted in future interviews with future experts. Okay. All right. Liz, do we need to wrap up here?
It's about 1 o'clock, so probably in the next couple of minutes.
Okay, so let me just talk about a couple things. One is, it's really important when you take the training to learn about the family's response to child sexual abuse, and it's also important for you to take the chapter on juvenile sexual offenders. I was telling Sonia when we were talking about this training about a case that we had, and this is years ago, but I remember it like it was yesterday. It was a dependency case where the children had been removed from the home and placed in relative placement they were placed together, okay? And they went to supervised visitation to visit with their father, and the reason was severe physical abuse, that basically the dad had beat the daylights out of the kids, okay? At supervised visitation, the visitation provider started to realize that there were some issues between the two kids. The boy was 11 or 12, and the girl was 6 or 7, okay? And the care manager and the caseworker did not know about what the visitation program eventually figured out about this case. And this was the reason the father had beat the children was because he walked into the bathroom and the brother was raping his sister. And the father went absolutely ballistic and started beating his son. The daughter was got in the way. She fell. She got a black eye. And he was not going to tell anybody that this is what happened. You know, there was this shame, shock, embarrassment. He was not going to label his kid a sexual offender. At the same time, so he was basically dealing with issues of, discipline, and he was acting as though he was taking all this therapy on dealing with his kids and age-appropriate responses and all this kind of thing. And really what the issue was his son had been sexually abusing his daughter. And the point is that people do have to understand what to be looking for. You have to have, and I know people are hanging up and I know you're going, but if you please take this training, you'll learn that the dynamics of child sexual abuse are complex, are vast, but are essential for you to try to learn about, and when you do, you will serve your clients much better. Thank you, Liz.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And everybody, this training will be on this statewide website, and we'll also have the documents that were talked about and the fabulous website and training that Karen and Sonia talked about where you can go and be trained on specific issues. It's really fantastic. So thank you, everyone, and we'll talk to you next month.